Welcome to The Urban Complex, a system of interrelated, emotion-charged ideas, feelings, memories, and impulses. This name takes the definition and lays out what a listener should expect. A podcast where ideas, feelings, and memories collide, leading towards meaningful change. I'm co-host Chris Richardson. Please enjoy the journey with The Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All opinions by Chris Richardson, Dominic Papa, and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Arizona State University or the Arizona Commerce Authority. Any endorsement of or messages from sponsors are solely supporting the production of this podcast. There is no relationship further than podcast purposes with any sponsor unless separately created with another entity.
All right, Dom, here we are again. What's top of mind as we have our guest coming up today?
No. You know, I'm excited. I was just thinking about it as we were kind of preparing for this meeting, how we haven't really had a transportation specific guest on today.
Not yet.
Yeah. And it's at least in my world, I'm sure in your world, transportation is like the prime topic that everyone is trying to figure out. I mean, we do a ton of work, whether it's the Institute for Automotive Mobility or working with MCDOT, which is our Maricopa County Department of Transportation, or ADOT, or Valley Metro, or MAG. I mean, there is just so much movement in the transportation space, especially coming out of a pandemic. And as we talk about reimagining cities and reimagining transportation agencies, it is just a big focus and big topic, especially here in Arizona. You know, we're going out for the transportation sales tax renewal in a year and a half. And so it's a big focus for I think a lot of cities across the country. And so I think it's going to be interesting because we do know LA and LA Metro has a couple, you know, big time events. We have the Super Bowl, they have the Super Bowl. I think it's just going to be a very interesting conversation. And I mean,
not to mention, as Maricopa County keeps growing so fast, our traffic keeps getting worse and worse. Okay. And I know COVID definitely put a damper. For those who don't know the Phoenix Valley, the summers, as it gets hot, we have snowbirds and they go back. Those that live half the year, we get a little reprieve. But boy, you can tell that COVID things are changing because traffic is growing again. Yep. So it'll be interesting to see how LA, which is not known for great traffic, is thinking about traffic. So transportation and whatnot. Yeah. So our guests today, I don't know them beforehand. They're with LA Metro. I actually met them through a mutual friend. I was over at their house and they had a guest in town, a gentleman named Jeremy Dan. He is faculty with University of Southern California, USC. Okay. Amazing guy. And first of all, for those that don't know who Clayton Christensen is, he is the he's unfortunately passed away. I got to meet him, but he's focused on the forces of competitive in business. Really super amazing thinker. And this good gentleman, Jeremy, worked with them directly out of college. And so built this amazing reputation. He's on all sorts of boards, really interesting guy. And I just told him about the Urban Complex. He goes, "Oh, I know who you need on the podcast. This is great how this works." Like it's funny how the world works like that. He goes, have you ever done anything with transportation? I said, "No, it'd be amazing." He goes, "Well, I'm on the advisory board of LA Metro." I'm like, "Bingo." Right? And so literally 4 weeks ago, he made the introduction. These guys were available. And that's the story. So I'm excited. I don't know. I'm assuming you didn't know either one of them, Josh.
Didn't know them. But I think, again, it's going to be an exciting conversation, especially as a lot of us are thinking about demand pricing and all sorts of weird, interesting things around transit. I think this is going to be a great conversation. Should we bring them in?
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Support for this episode of The Urban Complex comes from Worldwide Technology.
What if we could connect people to new possibilities, turn thinking into a way forward, solve problems before they become a problem, and share the future with everyone? We can. At WWT, we connect businesses to technology to make the impossible possible, to reach better decisions faster, to accelerate progress. Together, let's make a new world happen.
All right, Joshua Nolan, please let Dom and I give you a warm welcome to our podcast, The Urban Complex.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
No problem. Well, what we've found really helps set the stage is just starting with who you are, gives our audience a little bit of that background. So just tell us, you know, what's kind of your story, what's your background, how did you get to where you two are here today? And, you know, we'll get to your current roles, but just tell us a little about yourself.
So I like to think of myself as someone who has had a love affair with transportation from a very early age, and thus decided to make a career out of it. In fact, friends make fun of me for that specifically. Most people are like, oh, I didn't make a career out of my childhood toys, but I did. And I've had some seminal experiences that contributed to that, including the opportunity after living in one of these car-driven suburbs in the United States to live in the city of Paris and be set free into the metro that is Paris at the early age of 10. And I think I never lost sight of the freedom that that gave me, and decided to dedicate most of my life to trying to figure out how more people could have that kind of freedom, including children, but also everyone else who may or may not be able to access a car or may not want to access a car. So I spent most of my career doing that, both in the nonprofit sector and in government, and that led me here to Los Angeles.
Great. A little worried you were going to say that you took your parents' car for a spin at an early age, but it makes a lot of sense. I've spent some time living in France, so I can see why that's such a you know, unique idea. How about you, Nolan?
Yeah, it's kind of similar. Had to do a lot with my environment. I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, a town called Lansdowne, which is famous for having a large sycamore tree that's post-colonial and not much else. And but I was able to bike around, walk around, throw my baseball in the street, and then take the bus to, you know, the skateboarding store at the Springfield Mall. And then when I got to high school, take the train in. Started to care about cities, started to be intensely proud of being a Philadelphian, and wanted to play baseball at a small liberal arts college. And so I think in some ways my story is similar to Dominic's. I was watching the first ep, and you know, so this was life after sports for me. I didn't make the baseball team, so I had to pivot, but my whole identity was like, I'm still an athlete. That's what I am. So I played soccer for 2 years, but I studied abroad in Senegal. I learned that the world was a lot bigger and I wasn't getting much tick. So I decided to quit. And when I was sitting in there telling the program director I was quitting, he was like, what are you going to spend, you know, all this extra time on? I was like, oh God. I started looking around the room, and then I'm like, my major, urban and environmental policy, obviously huge growth industry. But I actually did. And I started to really get passionate about my senior comps and things. And I put together a good application for the Coro Fellowship, which I joined after college as a postgrad leadership and public affairs fellowship. And I was placed at Metro, and there was just so much energy that I joined as a trainee in the audit department. And at some point I got sort of plucked and I started staffing the CEO. The CEO changed over. The CEO was Phil Washington. He starts saying, I'm going to start this Office of Extraordinary Innovation. Then there's this current boss of mine, Joshua, shows up one day. And I went over as borrowed staff and I put in roots. So that's how I got there.
But, you know, it's funny, as I hear both of you talk, you might be interested in one of our former episodes. Have you heard of the company Cul-de-Sac?
No.
Check it out. Lava Sunder, their general manager, they've created a carless society that is started with a 17-acre project here in Phoenix, in Tempe, technically. We're not known as a very carless-friendly environment, but they have big plans. They're looking at additional rollouts of this. It's a really interesting project you guys mainly. Well, cool. So Nolan, you referenced the Office of Extraordinary Innovation. I would be lying if I didn't say I'm very intrigued, but yeah, let's bring it to what you're all doing now. Tell us what your roles are at LA Metro, kind of what you're doing in transportation, and what is the Office of Extraordinary Innovation?
Well, so Phil Washington, our CEO, created the office in 2015. And I think the initial idea for the office had to do with a couple of big factors. One was the rapid changing environment in transportation, that technology was driving a lot of major changes, right? In 2015, Uber and Lyft were no longer new on the scene. They were making a huge difference in what was happening in transportation. Smartphones were really embedded in society to the point where they were just becoming part of the fabric of almost everything regarding transportation. And transportation publicly, in the public sector, has long been seen as one of the least innovative sectors. I think government always has challenges in terms of bringing innovation in, but particularly in transportation, it's difficult. We're operating a lot of the same technologies and ideas that we were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So change is hard. And I think Phil wanted to create a vehicle by which that change could be accelerated. He wanted to make it a priority. And he created this office with the intention of doing that. The two main tools that we were given to do that were, one, working with the private sector on new ideas that they have. And that's Nolan's primary role, and he can talk more about that. And then setting the strategic direction for the organization. Because when you don't have a strategic direction, it's very difficult to find out what new things you might actually want to do, right? Most people are thinking like, well, an innovation office should be after the newest technology and trying out the coolest stuff. Well, yeah, but only in the service of some larger mission. Right. And so first we had to define, well, what is that mission? And that's what the strategic plan did.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I just love the fact that, you know, here's a visionary creating this office of extraordinary innovation, not just innovation, extraordinary. I love it. But then also gives you kind of the mandate to go pursue not only public-private partnerships, but also that strategic vision. I mean, that has to be, pretty powerful. I mean, right? To be able to set that sort of mission and vision for an organization like LA Metro. I mean,
well, I moved across the country to do it. So yes, I thought it was a pretty exciting opportunity. And I think Phil specifically chose the word extraordinary. You know, a lot of people, including myself, did not like that choice, frankly, because I felt like, you know, you're setting expectations very high, but that's his style. You know, his style is set high expectations and people will rise up to meet them. And I think that's exactly what happened. And he used to say, like, if you don't understand why it's called the Office of Extraordinary Innovation, you're missing the whole point. Like, we are trying to be far better. This is not just like, oh, let's do a little innovation on the side. This is a signature of what I'm trying to accomplish here at Metro.
I love it.
Perfect. You're the first representative of transportation. So we want to hear that extraordinary high bar. This is great.
Yeah, no pressure. So, you know, we laugh. This is Chris and I started this podcast. It's supposed to be a smart city podcast, but it's turned into, you know, this idea of us talking with leaders like yourselves and understanding kind of their views on smart cities, because as we all know, there's not one single definition. What we found, it's a journey, and it just depends on, you know, your certain circumstances. So will you two kind of give us your thoughts on, you know, what is smart cities to you? What is smart cities to kind of LA Metro, and how do you approach it? And maybe talk about some specifics to kind of really bring it home to our audience to understand how you guys view smart cities and maybe how you're furthering the effort in LA.
Yeah, I mean, let me talk about it generally, and then I think Nolan can provide some specific examples of things that we've done. But in general, I object to the term smart cities. So I'm going to start by not liking the term. Sorry about that. But
no,
the reason
no extraordinary, no smart cities. Check. Okay. Gotcha.
Well, it's the issue I have with it is, I think it's been used in a way to imply that the solution to every problem is technology.
Totally.
I just strongly disagree with that. I certainly think technology is a big part of innovation. It's not like we're technophobes. But the biggest issue in terms of doing things differently, trying to do new things, often doesn't boil down to technology at all. It boils down to the will, the political will, often, to make change. And so a lot of what we're about in the Office of Extraordinary Innovation is bringing those political questions front and center, putting them up for a discussion and saying, look, what do we want? Do we want to have a city that is, only people driving around in single occupancy vehicles until the end of time, until we just can't go anywhere and we're living completely choked by pollution? Or do we want to have something different than that? And if we want to have something different, technology can be a part of how we achieve that. But most of that is a change in mindset. a change in priorities and how we use our street space. And that's why I kind of push a lot more towards what are the core issues we need to get to in terms of change, and then how can technology help achieve that rather than starting with the technology. That said, we've done a lot of cool stuff with technology, and Nolan can talk about some of those projects that have, I think, made a real difference in terms of achieving that larger goal.
Yeah, I think Josh was on point just talking about how it really starts with the goals. One thing I do like about the term smart city is that it implies sort of a seamlessness and an efficiency of what is really a pretty complex ecosystem, you know, especially in LA, which is very multi-jurisdictional. And so I think it does give us an opportunity to think about how we can be customer focused and create good experiences, often using technology, or at least appreciating that there's a technological interface or an interface at all, like a touch point. Because, you know, behind the scenes, it's anything but, you know, simple, and the governance structure may not be that, you know, frankly, smart, you know, but that underpins it. So I see smart cities as somewhat of trying to reconcile like this individual user that's sort of, you know, ping ponging throughout the space, and then this, you know, vast array of policies and projects and funding sources and whatever that guides it. And when you can just say, yeah, but like, you know, do this, you know, this sort of remote control becomes pretty powerful, because those sensors out there can really make sense of that environment. But I think what Joshua really teed me up to kind of talk about is just the some of the projects that we pursued in earnest in the smart city space. Mm. So I can give one example, two examples, three examples. But through each of these, I mean, I've learned a lot, because we basically, you know, Joshua's just kind of empowered me to be like, just try, communicate, figure out the value proposition, you know, communicate it, try to projectize it to make up a word. And then try to measure it. And so we started a drone program that started with just like an unsolicited proposal for a person saying, let's do track inspection using drones. It's actually not the best use case for drones, but drones are valuable for data collection. So we flew just a roof, right, with thermal imaging. And it wasn't like all that helpful. We were like, okay, why was this not that helpful? Well, because it's kind of like being a dentist, where you're like, that doesn't make you good. Being good at taking pictures of teeth does not make you a dentist. Being good at taking pictures of a roof doesn't make you an engineer or somebody who understands how to like operationalize, you know, the asset repair strategy. But later we learned enough to get that. We just sort of demystified it, got a drone up in the air, and then we flew the rail to rail project. And it only cost $3,000, but we collected 12,000 images in a day and proved not only that we could get a drone up in the air, but that we could do it in the most restrictive airspace in Los Angeles County. And actually, we calculated volumetrics on just a pile of dirt. We didn't know that pile of dirt was going to be relevant to us. But then the next day, the construction department needed to know how many trucks to send out to excavate that pile of dirt. And we knew, like, exactly, because we knew how big the... And so... Flash forward, you know, a few years later, I have my Part 107 license. We have used it for site monitoring for construction. Our marketing team has gone viral, creating, you know, marketing content and videos. And so we just sort of organically grew this thing from a pretty unsuccessful flight on a roof. And I can give, and I will over the course of this, give, you know, a few more examples that are similar.
I love it. I think that's an awesome use case, or just an example of, You might not know what you're getting into when you start a project or a program, but look, you were able to kind of continually innovate throughout the process of it. I don't know. It's just amazing. I absolutely love this kind of idea. And, you know, Joshua, I love the idea of the smart city, because Chris knows that I'm a little bit of a governance nerd. And I think smart cities to me is more about, you're right, the policy, the partnerships. How are we structuring what we do in order to do more things kind of in a more innovative way? And so I'm loving this conversation already. And there's a couple, you know, a sports guy here now. This is just becoming a great conversation. So let's dive a little deeper though. I mean, talk to me. I mean, you know, I deal with on a daily basis, a lot of cities in my role. I have to deal with the state government as well. I mean, COVID in running a public transit operation. I mean, talk to us about what it was like to kind of operate a public transit operation in the midst of COVID. What was the challenge? How has it shaped where you're at and what you're thinking, and maybe what you're thinking for the future? Talk to us a little bit about what it's like, because I know there's probably a lot of people listening that are either running, you know, Valley Metros of the world or public transit agencies. So talk to us about what you've gone through in the past year.
Wow. Well, it's certainly been quite a year. I think there's a few things that perhaps make it not as bad as you might think, right? So one is that we depend on revenues from fares far less than other transit agencies. Most of our funding comes from sales taxes and other taxes. So we were not hurt nearly as badly as many other transit agencies, particularly places like London or New York, where they depend on so much on fares for their revenue. Second, we were really proud of the fact that during the pandemic, we didn't lose that many riders and compared to other agencies. We were down about, you know, 40 to 50%. We're now up to like closer to 60. And the reason is that we were providing essential rides for essential workers. I mean, these are people who had to get to work to make the economy continue to function. And a large proportion of our riders are essential workers, are low-income people, much larger than most other major agencies. Mm. So we felt really proud of the fact that we were performing this essential function during this time, and weren't really thinking about, how do we survive? We had those advantages. But the third thing that I think was really, that we really harnessed, and this is where the innovation office comes in, is that the pandemic did open a lot of people's eyes to what is possible in a post-pandemic environment. One, that we don't have to have streets clogged with cars all the time, even though that's already starting to come back. There was a time when we all saw, oh, wow, this is what it's like when we can walk down the street peacefully, or when I can bike without being afraid of getting mowed over, you know? Like, this is what it was like. It kind of showed people what things could be like. This is what it's like to breathe clean air. And then a second component was that there was this overlap with, you know, today's the anniversary of George Floyd's death. I mean, this is an overlap with this tremendous social justice movement that drew attention to the inequities in our society, and that exposed, frankly, the inequities in transportation, in the fact that so many of our riders were still there because they had no choice, and that we needed to serve them. So public transit, a lot of people think, you know, a lot of elites, I guess, would say, well, public transit, we need to get more people on there so I can free up the road for me to drive on it faster, right? And that tends to be a lot of the movement behind public transit. But the fact is that public transit is an essential service for people who depend on it for their daily livelihood. And I think that was exposed very clearly during the pandemic. So we tried to harness some of that with our recovery task force work. And you can look at our recovery task force report. It's on the website, that tries to say, okay, what can we harness from this experience so that we don't return back to the inequitable, polluted, congested system that we had prior to the pandemic, and instead try to create something different. And so in many ways, we saw a lot of opportunity in this event.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I think you always need to see opportunity, you know, in the midst of a challenge. That's perfect. So you talked about this kind of recovery task force. Any kind of big successes that you can talk about? Any initiatives that you would like to highlight for, you know, for our audience to hear about what you were able to kind of deploy or promote during, you know, during COVID or during the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. One, the idea of slow streets, of having streets that are more for people and bikes and not just for cars, is something that was a recovery task force recommendation to try to keep some of that going. And our board picked up on that and made some of the money that we usually might spend on other things available to create, for cities to create slow streets across LA County. So we were really happy about that one. We talked a lot in the recovery task force report about providing incentives for people to find any other mode of traveling besides driving alone. And we are now pursuing in part because of unsolicited proposals we received, but in part because of the recovery task force, this idea of rewarding people through incentives for doing that. And kind of the gamification of travel to say, you know, if you, even if you telecommute, if you bike, if you walk, if you do anything other than drive alone, could there be a reward at the end of that so that we're kind of just nudging people away from the default? Because the pandemic's a great time for a reset, right? It's a great time to rethink, like, oh, a lot of people are doing right now. Like, do I really need to be in the office every day? Well, do I really need to drive every day? And is there some other way I could organize my life that wouldn't be as difficult as sitting in traffic all the time? So those are just a couple examples of how we're trying to do that. There are a lot of recommendations in the report, and some of them are kind of in midway through implementation, but you're going to see a lot more coming to fruition over the next few months.
I love it. I think this is awesome. I mean, I love this conversation, especially I love the idea around slow streets and really kind of prioritizing pedestrians. You know, we here in Phoenix, at least we've got a major issue around pedestrian fatalities. So, you know, when I was doing, you know, kind of diving deep into some of the work you guys are doing, I would love for you to talk a little bit about your vision 2028, you know, in some of the things that you're shooting for in that document, because I think it really sets a leadership example, not only for obviously Phoenix, but the entire country about what can happen or what we should be thinking about. Talk to us a little bit about Vision 2028 and kind of some of the things you're thinking about with that.
Yeah, so Vision 2028, our strategic plan, is essentially it gets at the same issue that Nolan deals with every day, that we all deal with at Metro every day, which is that there's a lot of siloed thinking, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thinking about, like, well, what's the problem in front of me and how do I improve that? As opposed to the broader big picture thinking that is so critical to actual problem solving, right? And so when Nolan gets a new idea in for an unsolicited proposal for new technology, his job is to build support for that because it achieves the agency mission, not necessarily because it just makes one department's work better, right? And the same thing is true of the strategic plan. The strategic plan was, instead of the narrow view of a transit agency, which is typically our job, is to get more riders and make sure that they're safe and make sure that they have the journey's efficient and make sure we're spending public money wisely. Like, those are the traditional missions that you would see of a transit agency. We took a much broader view. Why are people giving us their hard-earned money? Why are people voting overwhelmingly twice, 2/3 votes in 2008, 2016 to give us their sales tax money? It's not because they want more people on public transit. It's not because they want a better public transit system necessarily. They see those as potential means to the end. The reason they're giving us their money is that the transportation system isn't working for them and they want it to change. And that transportation system that isn't working, what we did in Vision 2028 is take responsibility for solving that challenge. And instead of saying our mission is to improve transit or ridership on transit, our mission is to get more people to be able to travel without using a car by themselves. That's our mission. And that's a big difference and a big change and a big shift. And it has led to so many things that we would not have been doing were it not for that mission shift, right? I mean, some of our biggest projects right now, we're looking at our traffic reduction study looks at whether we can price the roads in order to improve traffic. The travel rewards thing I just mentioned about nudging people is not just about transit ridership. The idea that we're looking at a fareless system, that we're looking at making transit free. I mean, well, those are things that couldn't be considered under a regular transit mission. And that's why Vision 2028 has been so critical.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, it's completely inspiring. I mean, this idea, what I basically just heard is, you know, think outside I hate the term, think outside the box, but like break down barriers, build up partnerships. Like, let's think about transit in a new kind of holistic systems level approach way that's not typical of, you know, your transit organizations, your DOTs, you know what I mean? That's just not how they naturally function. And so I think this is kind of a leadership example for organizations all across the country. I love it. I love this approach. It really kind of hits on the smart city theme about, you know, thinking differently. So let's maybe talk about something fun, because, you know, here in Phoenix, we're going to host the Super Bowl in 2023. Of course, then you guys have the Olympics in what, 2028, I believe.
We have the Super Bowl coming up, in 2022, right here.
That's right. So
go before you, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I know. We've had a couple of initial conversations about, you know, Mayor Garcetti and Mayor Gallego here, and how might we be able to collaborate around big events like this? But as a transit organization, I mean, when you've got the Olympics coming, I mean, a international global event like that, how do you plan for that? I mean, tell us something unique about kind of your mindset around these, you know, worldwide events and how LA and LA Metro sorts of kind of plans for these things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it won't surprise you based on what I've been saying already, that when I think about planning for these things, I think about how can we accomplish the goal that we care about with the least amount of investment, like least amount of money and least amount of time investment, because we all want to move people faster. We want to move people faster in time for the Olympics, and we want to do that in a way that helps people now. And then after the Olympics. So the Olympics is just a catalyst for getting a lot of these things done. And if you think about what that means, there are some of our big projects like the West Side Purple Line and some others, Regional Connector, that are going to be complete in time for the Olympics, and they're going to make a big difference in terms of moving people. But a lot of the function of moving people for the Olympics and before and after the Olympics is about using our streets more effectively than we're currently doing. And the way we're currently using our streets and allowing them to be taken up almost entirely by single occupancy vehicles means that we're not able to move as many people as we're going to need to do for the Olympics or as for the Super Bowl or for life in Los Angeles. So that's why we've spent a lot of time thinking about how can we get more bus lanes? Mm. How can we get express? But one of the Recovery Task Force recommendations was, can we get express buses onto the HOV lanes and make the HOV lanes move by bumping up the occupancy requirement, for example? Can we find ways to enable cities to make decisions that allow bike lanes to be constructed so that we're not reliant on single occupancy vehicles for moving everything everywhere? Can we provide the incentives for telecommuting? So it's a lot of those same things that we need to do to make Los Angeles work. We're going to have to do to make the Olympics work. And so we're trying to use that as a catalyst to get a lot of those things going.
That's great. You know, I have a question. The way we actually met was through a mutual colleague, Jeremy Dan. I'm curious, he's on your advisory board. Is that something unique to the Extraordinary Innovation? Or to LA Metro, do most metros and transportation groups have an external advisory board? And if not, either way, just talk about how you use that group. I mean, for those that don't know, Jeremy, he worked with Clayton Christensen early on kind of analysis of competitive forces, and he does all sorts of amazing stuff, I believe, at USC around. So it's great to have someone like that kind of working with you. I know that this kind of just got me thinking as you were explaining how you're looking at this. And I have a funny feeling that the advisory board plays a big part of that. Anything you can say there?
Yeah, well, so the advisory board does play a big role. There are lots of groups that Metro convenes to advise them on various things, you know, technical advisory committee. And I don't know, Nolan knows all the, there's a whole bunch of them, right? We created the OEI advisory board because I come from the nonprofit sector most recently. And the way that I found that I learned and I was able to get ideas out there that made a difference was by having a bunch of really smart people who have experience hear all the ideas and tell me what to do about them, right?
In a really diverse way, right? Not just transportation folks, but like very broadly, yeah. Right?
Well, because we were tasked with not just transportation, but with innovation itself. And so we tried to bring people in from transportation, but also who had been involved in making change or an innovation in other sectors to reflect back to us. Like when we say, particularly at the beginning, right? When we were trying to figure out like, how do we make change? What do we do? We had these folks who were like, oh, I've been through this. We had a guy from Northrop Grumman, I remember, who gave us some great advice. He was like, yeah, I had to set this up in Northrop Grumman. here are all the things that are going to happen to you.
I wanted to predict the future in your transportation world.
Like he knew he'd been through it before. So it's been incredibly helpful. And people like Jeremy and others there was one quick story. We were struggling at one point with a partnership we were trying to put together with Lyft to do some on-demand mobility services. And we were working with them and we could not come to agreement. And we went to our advisory board and we're like, you know, here's the benefits of staying with them. And here's the problems with staying with them. And they were like, you have to get rid of them, you idiot. Why are you still, you know, it was just such an obvious decision for them. And because they had this outside perspective, like, why are you still hanging out with these people? They're not, they don't have your best interests at heart. So there have been times like that when their input is.
And now, now Lyft knows what happened.
Well, no, I already told them that. I already told them that because we switched to Via, and Via was a great partner for 2 years, and they were much more aligned with our interests, and that worked out.
Well, so you mentioned that helped spur the ideas, and I think you referenced earlier the unsolicited proposals policy. Tell us about that. Like, what is it? How does it work? And what's it led to? It sounds exciting. A lot of our guests bring forward these unique ways to get information, get ideas, get pilots moving.
I'll let Nolan take that one.
Yeah, so it's a policy that came with Phil Washington that formally allows companies to submit outside ideas, actually any party, outside party, to submit ideas to us. And actually, based in part on that guy from Northrop Grumman and some things that just sort of happened through the process, people inside Metro can submit too. But mm-hmm. It's a way of bringing good ideas to the table in an actionable way and in a collaborative way, because what we do when we receive the idea is we set up a cross-functional review team to look at it and then either seek to implement it outright, seek to get more information about it, or reject it. We've gotten 250 proposals over the years. We've implemented over 19 projects, and we formalized and then implemented like 8 proofs of concept as well. And we can certainly get into more of the results, you know, some of the great things that have happened, like the creation of the P3 office for alternative project delivery, and a couple of pretty special projects, including new mobility and smart cities projects. But I think more than the ideas that have come in, it's just been a really good like decision-making apparatus. It really, we have to give a response to the person who submitted, the firm that submitted the idea. And Joshua will not like sign the letters if they're not well justified. So we use it as a sort of a proxy to really, you know, delve into certain issues and values. And if we say it can't be this, then it's just, well, then what? I mean, do we acknowledge the problem? Then how about this solution? So, you know, timing matters, collaboration matters, some things have to be escalated, but it just gives us, you know, an ability to advocate for, develop, implement, and sort of get traction for these innovative projects that not only have impacted our core service, like Metro Microtransit, or Metro Micro, which is microtransit, and doing P3s for major capital projects, but it's also led to us doing like, you know, completely new things, new ventures, research and development, technological deployments. So yeah, we're proud to have that that program, but I'll tell you that program would not be, you know, what it is without leadership at the top and without a strategic plan to guide the sorts of things Metro ought to get into. Because that without that, what leg are you standing on when you're, you know, knocking at the door of a department saying, here's an innovative idea, you know, could just feel like another unfunded mandate.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So you've got these ways to bring in ideas from outside. You got this unsolicited proposal policy that brings in ideas from industry and other venues. You got ways to process this stuff. You've kind of got your vision outlined, and you've got some big events that can help catalyze that. So let's say after the Olympics, or maybe even earlier after the Super Bowl, as we're planning for ours, we get you all back on. Like, what do you think the big thing that'll happen that you all are making waves for? Like, you mentioned you're trying to get less people driving individually. Like, what does that look like?
Well, I think that's best encompassed in our traffic reduction study, which is ongoing right now. And I think that's the thing. We hope to get a pilot in place for that by 2025. That would be the game changer for Los Angeles if we're able to do that, right? So if you're familiar with congestion pricing, it's the idea of of charging people based on time of day to drive on roads, right? So it exists in London and Stockholm and Singapore and Milan, and it works, right? And our theory here is if we can just build enough support for trying this somewhere in LA County for some period of time, then people will like it and they'll want more of it.
And it's not that you take away options, because you still have your public transportation for getting people if they need to during the time and they don't want to pay the premium.
You should be providing more options.
Right.
The idea is that it's not just pricing. It is adding more options at the same time that you're putting in that pricing.
And you're incentivizing to pay to play, but to move away from the things at peak times just to get the best result. That's really interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting, this is where innovation is not about technology, but is about using what you have more effectively, right? It doesn't take that many people to stop driving at a peak time to make the highway flow.
No, not at all.
Like you know,
especially
that.
At certain spots, because there's always the two or three bottlenecks that cause the entire thing to be backed up forever.
Exactly. And I don't know if it's like this in Phoenix, but here, when LAUSD, when the school system's not in session, you can tell. You know, when it's Yom Kippur, you can tell. Like, there are things that happen that the traffic just moves that day. And so it's not that many people to make a difference. And so if just a few people are able to be like, you know what, I can go to a different time. I don't need to drive at this time. Or I can take the bus. Or I can bike. Or I can telecommute. Or any of those other things. Right now, we're not asking them to make those choices, because we're just saying anyone can drive at any time and it's always the same price, which is zero. So it's a really interesting and exciting idea. I think it has tremendous power to make a real difference, both in terms of traffic, but also in terms of the inequities in the system. Because when you take that money and you reinvest it in other options and make those options even better that aren't driving, you're helping the people who don't have access to cars far more than you are today. So
it's also amazing to me, I'm not in it, although I do work at Arizona State University. It does take time. Dominic works for the state of Arizona. It does take time. When I was saying, I threw it out like, okay, when we compare notes for the Super Bowl, you're like talking 2025. You're not talking 2022. So I get it. And you're trying to find the right place. You're trying to get all the right input. You're trying to build a model so that when it goes, it doesn't fall on its face, like then you get the right beachhead, and then you kind of expand out and go from there. Yeah, it's really, really interesting to think about.
I'd just like to, you know, just plug the bus improvements that are kind of forthcoming, because I think those make a big, big difference, and they're sort of smart city-esque. I mean, it all comes down to systems thinking, right? And how do you optimize, you know, certain things with little incremental improvements here and there, especially using some economic concepts that are harder to realize without technology. But just an example, another unsolicited proposal we got had me in a bus lane on Wilshire Boulevard with a little smartphone, capturing instances of people blocking bus lanes that then became, you know, led to more research, which became the basis for AB 917, which is going to be up for a floor vote in the assembly pretty soon today. But if we can get bus lanes operating as they're intended, you know, and the bus becomes, you know, safer, faster, and more reliable, then you just
sort of... So the citizen takes a picture and releases it?
Turn the bus. So currently you're not allowed to use cameras to enforce bus lanes in the state of California, except for authorizing, enabling legislation that San Francisco and Alameda Contra Costa have. AB 917 would authorize... Metro and all transit agencies to collect data using their buses at bus stops and in bus lanes that then cities can use to enforce the parking laws that already exist but are not followed. But these are just sort of the little things we can do. The Better Bus program that we have, again, strategic planning, but of these programs, projects, and initiatives and people, as a laundry list of other really important investments in the waiting experience, bringing shade, bringing better real-time information, all this stuff. But it just serves up to a bigger program that's trying to turn the tide to make transit just have a stronger value proposition, because it's going to need to if we're going to meet our goals.
Yeah, and I hope I know we a lot of these things, like we're saying, oh, we want to do this, and then we did this, and then it happened. But we're skipping a lot of steps. I mean, I don't know if you can appreciate how much effort Nolan had to put in to corral, how many different people he had to like bring together to get to the point where we're now actually considering legislation on this issue. Like something very minor like that, people who don't work in government may not appreciate how difficult it is to get to.
Oh, no, I see Dom's face lighten up. I'm the IT guy. He knows.
I was like, wow. That's impressive. Yeah, I think, Joshua, thank you for pointing that out, because I think people will pass that up pretty easily. Like, oh, it must have been that easy to just all of a sudden get legislation to be even be thought of. No, that is a huge lift. So, Nolan, congrats, my friend.
We like to – Joshua's modeling one of our, you know, tenets in the office is to, you know, give credit, take blame. And in that spirit, like, can't do it without leadership. Also, you know – we had to do our homework, but you know, Assemblymember Bloom is carrying that bill. It's you know, it's really hard to do. Our government relations team gave me some advice that kept this thing from dying like many times. And so
It leads in nicely to our last question that we asked kind of all the guests is like, we know you can't do these things on your own. And you know, Joshua, you're already appreciating Nolan here for all the work to get that moving. Is there anyone that either of you want to recognize in your own journey on getting this transportation vision that you all have that you're going forward with, as well as just like Jeremy Dan, I'm really appreciative he introduced us. We wouldn't have had our first transportation focus on the urban complex. But is there, as you think about someone to appreciate, let us know if they should be a great guest. Like we're always looking for people to get on the show and tell the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the person I appreciate the most in this is my boss, right? He made this all happen. He's the reason that we have an office. He's backed us 99% of the time when we tried to change things and make a difference. I mean, he's had the courage to put forward a lot of these things. You know, when I often tell this story, I met with him before I decided to take this job, and I said, if I take this job, here are the four crazy ideas that I want to put in LA County. And he said yes to every single one of them. And they are all things that we are doing right now. A lot of things I've been describing to you were initial ideas that we had 5-6 years ago. He backed them all. So he's number one. But I'd say, you should talk to some of the folks at UCLA who've been along with us for this journey. Brian Taylor, if you haven't talked to him already. He has been a part of this, and his colleague Marty Wax, who unfortunately passed away. They've been part of this since the beginning, and a part of our advisory board, and guided us through so many of these things that it's just been an invaluable resource. They've taken time, given us pro bono work on it, because it's something that they care passionately about as well.
And for my shout outs, besides, you know, my immediate team, I think there's two. One is Joshua talked about how the pandemic showed us how much we not only need to get around, but the people around us need to get around to help us and for life, and how valuable transportation, how essential mobility is for people. And the bus operators were the ones that really did that. And I was in my house. So I'm very humbled by that. Similarly, in my work, using partnerships to enhance the delivery of, you know, public services, that generally comes down to some form of contracting. And we have just created such a special and unique and kind of surprising relationship with the vendor contract management department, especially our colleague, Carolina Capolo, to really embrace the innovation and operationalize it. Because when Phil wanted to search, Phil Washington, the CEO, and I'm sure our new incoming CEO, Stephanie Wiggins, feels the same, to search the world for the best ideas in transportation and implement them at Metro, the implement them at Metro part was really, really important. And without the actual, you know, people in the departments that were, you know, carrying the projects, becoming the champions, as well as the tone at the top, that wouldn't have happened. And for me, all this procurement innovation, you know, is really thanks to Carolina.
Yeah, it's really interesting how you bring it back to that, because if you don't have vehicles to move something forward, it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So,
well, this is great. Absolutely extraordinary. I'm sure, you know, it's going to be fun to see. We'll have to have you back. I know these things take some time. You know, LA definitely has challenges. I lived in Torrance for a bit, and to get up there. So you guys are inspirational to make this happen. I'm looking forward to seeing the outcomes. But with that,
we'd even
make complex gives a big Lakers joke. Yeah, what's that?
Is that we'd even make a Suns Lakers joke? Games tonight.
Good point. We haven't yet.
Go Sixers. No, I'm actually going to the Clippers game.
I love it.
Little nervous about being able to exploit Chris Paul. We'll see. But yeah. So today's guest, Joshua Shank, Chief Innovation Officer at Los Angeles County Metropolitan, and Nolan Borgman, Manager of Transportation Planning, Office of Extraordinary Innovation. Thanks, gentlemen. We're inspired by what you're doing. Can't wait to see what results.
Thank you. It's been great.
Well, once again, a quick reminder to everyone, we're open if you have ideas for guests. I had a friend that kind of opened the door to these guests, and it was amazing, Don. Like, what do you think?
This was a great conversation. I'm excited that we were able to get LA Metro as our first transit organization. I mean, there's probably none bigger in the world, maybe besides New York. But I thought the conversation was amazing. You know, what really stuck out to me was this idea around this advisory group. Like, why almost probably every private organization, private company, industry partner has an advisory group that they go to get advice, feedback, you know, thoughts and opinions on. Why don't more of our governments have these sorts of like ad hoc advisory groups? I just love that. I love that conversation about, man, we were probably stuck with Lyft. We were stuck. And then we went to the advisory.
Like, well, get rid of them. What are you doing? Yeah. Like, you're not, no one's got your gunpoint.
It was so easy for an outside group that wasn't involved in the conversation to say, what are you doing? And it's like, oh, what are we doing? This makes sense. I never really heard. I mean, governments have committees and stuff like that, but nothing like an advisory.
We haven't heard it come up on the podcast so far. And you know what's really cool is early on when he was talking about the vision, like he talked about the siloed nature. And you're right. If you don't have that outside perspective, and when I offered it up as a question, he goes, yeah, we got like 10 of them. It's hard to keep them all straight. So clearly it's not just one advisory. They're getting technical advisory. They're getting probably citizen advisory, rider advisory. You could just tell that's a common way that they look at it that I don't think is common to others. So I'm glad you stressed that.
Yeah. And to me, it doesn't sound like a formalized committee where they have to have a quorum to meet or anything like that. It just literally
who's taking the minutes.
Yeah. It's literally sounds like a group they can bounce ideas off of informally. I mean, what better mechanism for a city manager, a CIO, a smart city advisor, just to have a group like that you can just bounce ideas, thoughts, exchanges off. I thought that was great. And then I think the other thing that I really wanted to point out was this idea of the unsolicited proposal policy. I just love that idea because, you know, so many times we don't want to hear what you think. We don't want to hear your ideas, but then we don't know what we don't know. Like, why not let people bring us ideas of challenges they perceive with our service or with our organization or with our delivery, you know? And then what I think Nolan mentioned, he's like, you know, we have to evaluate them. We have to look through them. And then maybe sometimes we're like, okay, the technology doesn't work, but they brought up a good point. Maybe this is a problem.
Yeah, it's such an intentional use of words, unsolicited.
Yeah.
But yet it's structured to generate 250 proposals. Guess what? It's not like they asked for this stuff and 19 implemented, 18 POCs. Probably doesn't take that long to read an unsolicited bid. Some of these things are probably not super well. It's not like a 42-page memorandum, right? And so they just dig in. And with that thinking, some things I thought was interesting. You heard them talk about the drones, and they went into the drones. All right, we're going to look at rooftops. Well, they didn't really like what they first saw. But then they said, wait a second, we've got this long corridor. Let's go take a bunch of pictures of that. And then someone said, hey, we need to get trucks to that section of the corridor. And someone had the thought, oh, let's look at what the drone looked at. And then like marketing's like, wait a second, we can use these pictures to give stuff that actually increases our social awareness. And I just think it's really interesting how they start layering and layering and trying new things. I know at ASU, when we start with something small, but we're thinking big, we see this all the time. It's interesting how that thing then gets applied to the next thing and then gets layered in and gets additive. Right. I don't know. I just think that's really cool how they approach it. And then, you know, kind of in that vein, they use that example of the buses and they were super pumped, right? They saw that people want to take photos, but there's no mechanism for the bus drivers or for, you know, whoever's on the bus to kind of show what's not being done. They've got the law that can enforce this stuff. And we all know that, you know, you can have self-police. I mean, if the citizens care and they want to get these people out of the way, I know if I was parked there, if I was stuck behind someone parked in a lane, need to get through, and there was a way to get it moved quick, it'd work. And so they were super excited about how policy is changing and how they can influence that. I don't know. I figured that would tap into your interest too.
Oh no, I love it. I love just their mindset and their approach to innovation. Extraordinary innovation. I mean, just the name of that office is amazing. I'm excited. Maybe there's, you know, some synergy, some collaboration that we might be able to do between ASU, Phoenix, Greater Phoenix, Arizona, and LA Metro. I mean, they're thinking boldly, and I always love that kind of leadership. So I'm excited for, you know, what might happen in the future between us.
Speaking of thinking boldly and getting some big awareness, let's move into cracks in the pavement. I know you pinged me. You got something you're pumped to share. Breaking news here, Urban Complex.
I got a good one. I mean, we had Mark and Rosa from the city of Tempe on as one of our first guests, and Tempe was actually named among the world's smart 50 cities because of the work that they did around the wastewater science program, partnership with ASU. So congrats, Chris, and your organization.
Oh, I did a lot with that.
Yeah. But I think again, you know, you have to celebrate success together. And here's a program that, you know, they spoke very highly of and how they were using data and data science to really analyze wastewater in unique ways. I think it first started out geared towards opioid use in the pandemic we're seeing around that, but then it was shifted to analyzing wastewater against the COVID pandemic. And so, you know, again, I just think here is a program, an exciting program that we were able to share here on the Urban Complex. And I saw the article today that they actually won the award for it. So I just thought it was really cool. And kudos.
Yeah, it's called the Smart 50 Awards by Smart Cities Connect.
Yep.
And they're in some amazing company there. So we'll have to give them a shout out. That sounds exciting. And we heard it. I mean, think about it. They had such a unique interplay, and they were talking about the wastewater back then because it's all about data, and they're not afraid of public partnerships, right? They like you said, they worked with ASU and they got the best of research and they helped share data. And you could just see that they're doing great things. It's great to see them getting that accolades and ASU's biggest campus is in Tempe. So
yep, yeah, I actually saw. I think Dr. Crow posted President Crow posted about it today. That's I think how I saw it. And again, I think, you know, I think what's exciting about the Urban Complex and this podcast and what we're doing is the fact that, you know, that's an easy implementable program for cities all across the country. I mean, you know, a lot of the jurisdictions control, manage, operate wastewater treatment facilities. And here's an opportunity
Only open to tell the story here, but they'll follow up if anyone wants. I'd be happy to make introductions. You know, Mark, you know, Rosa, they'd be happy to tell the story. Yeah. I know Ralph at ASU, he'd be happy to share. So if anyone wants to learn more about anything that's going on, feel free. We'd be happy to make introductions.
So congrats, Tempe. Well done. Look forward to telling more stories like that.
Yeah. Cool. And with that, it's a wrap. Thanks for joining the Urban Complex.
Yep. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Complex, smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. Please find us on where you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. We do love your feedback. Let us know if you have ideas for guests or questions to air on Cracks in the Pavement via social media. The Urban Complex is found on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Or just shoot me an email, chris@theurbancomplex.com. Till next time.